Hi, everybody, and welcome. And I'm here just to tell you a little bit about David and about Brian. David here has been coming to the Wolfson House, I guess, for the last 8 or 9 years. And he has a heart for the knowledge of AA in the big book, and I got back when I got to know him. And here at the house, we do about 8 seminars a year, and we get people from all over the country coming. And this is one of our things, is being a nonprofit foundation is educational. And we do have the top people in the country coming. And I'm very grateful for that. And how David got here from Boston is another story. There's one person I admire very much for his knowledge of the big book. And he also lives it by doing many, many things. Now, when I heard him, I was just absolutely amazed. And each time he comes, this is his third year here, and we've had quite a few local people, but their lives have been changed by him, by what they got out of the big book. And it just opened up, and he does have a gift for it. A lot of them call it, you know, hardline AA and book thumpers. I'm one of them. I love it. I can't get enough of it. And don't be afraid of it. The big book, it will not hurt you. And they say hide something in the big book. But I'm one of the people, like David, that I want everything I can get out of life. And all the promises in the big book, there's so many promises. But you know that joke, you know, if you want to hide something, put it in the big book. You know, that's what keeps people sick. It's what you want to do. If you have, bring a big book with you, learn. And again, David is one of the gifted people to be able to present the big book. So I'm going to let it go and just, why don't we give him a little applause just for them being here, start it going.
Hi, everybody. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here today. As you said, it's the third year I've been here. It's a gift to be able to come here and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also been a big part of my ongoing spiritual growth to carry this message. And it came about in a way that I didn't expect, and that's just another example of how God is directing my life today. And if I just continue to do what I take in as God's will for me, what I call the spiritual proof keeps coming to me that my spirit gets better and my life gets better. I'm very honored to have Brian Connors with me today. For the last 2 years, I've had my spiritual advisor, George, was with me, and Brian I've known probably as long as I've known George, and I felt very lucky to have him available to come and start doing this with me. So, I'd like to start by thanking the Wilson House and its staff. Ozzy and Bonnie and the volunteers and even some of the paid staff that helped put this seminar on and put all the seminars on throughout the year. I've been to some of the other seminars and they've been a big help to me in my growth. I also like to thank Glenn Kay, who provides the service of the tapes, which are another very big source of growth for people and listening to all kinds of recovery, AA stuff. About the seminar. I don't know that I'm a big book thumper, but I do live the big book. And so when I got to the 12th step, my sponsor told me, he made clear what it's all about. You know, and it says we carry this message. So I'm here to carry the message that is outlined in the book, along with my experience. It worked for me. You know, I've had a spiritual awakening. My life I've been restored to sanity. As it says in the 10th step, I don't think of alcohol at all. I'm not tempted, you know, because I've stayed in fit spiritual condition. And that's the way it goes for me. And what else is happening is as I keep practicing these principles, life just keeps getting better and better. And, you know, that's not what I did this for. I did this 12-step process for, because I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. And I didn't know what my problem was. And I'm very grateful that I found the people that had helped me through this process. Before we get started into the book, one of the things I wanted to mention was about what are the 12 steps, and because I didn't know what I'd spent 2 years in AA, and I didn't really know what really what my problem was or what the 12 steps were about. I came into AA and I thought my problem was drinking. And I used to read step one as saying, I admitted, that was for me, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. And so I assumed that if I put alcohol down, my life was going to become manageable. So for 2 years, I tried to manage my life. I took some suggestions. I asked God in the morning. And then I even thought I had done a third step. And I, but the problem was is that, and I didn't discover this until I hit a second bottom in about 2 years, is that I was going right back out and trying to run my life according to David's rules and thinking. And I don't look back and think that I was wrong. You know, I stress that there's really not a wrong here. It's just the fact that I didn't know. You know, the book says the alcoholic life was the only one we knew, and that's the only life I knew. So I took some suggestions to the best of my ability. And then I went out and did what I thought I was supposed to do. Well, I'm grateful that I crashed again, you know, because it got me to the willingness to seek out direction. We'll talk more about the third step in a little while, but, you know, the 12-step, Bill says the 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, and if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession for alcohol and make our lives hopefully useful. And I like that definition. When I started into the 12 steps in the book, the problem was I didn't understand any of those words. I didn't understand spirituality. I didn't understand really what a principle was. And my life had never been hopefully useful, so I had no conception of what it meant to really be, because I was a self-seeker. I had to find that out. There were just so many things I didn't know. So I like that definition of the 12 steps, you know, of what we're supposed to do here. So what we're going to do today and tomorrow is we've broken down. We're going to go through the chapters, and we're gonna not read everything out of the book. We don't have time to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to pick certain things to read out of each chapter, and we're going to share our experience on that. We try not to go any further than that. Because, I, as Ozzie said, you know, I just believe that if we do the basics, and this is what I did. I did the basics in the book, and everything worked just fine. You know, I don't want to stretch this out or really get too much of my opinions into it. I will state if it is my opinion, though. So we're going to go through the book, and then what we're going to do is, at the end of the morning session, we're going to open it up for some questions. Maybe 10 minutes of questions if anybody has any questions. The other thing I wanted to mention, in case I forget later, is we're going to be willing to be available tonight, you know, like maybe 7 to 9 in the small meeting room if people, because we're going to be ending the fourth step by dinner time. So if people want to let us know early whether you're interested in meeting with us, I think there might even be a sign-up sheet. We're willing to be available to discuss, you know, the steps in the book further, especially the fourth step. Let me just check my... So I think what we'll do now is Brian's going to introduce himself, and then after his introduction, get us into the book. Brian?
Thank you, David. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brian.
I'm a member of the Marshfield Men's Big Book Step Study Group meets in Marshfield Hills on Thursday night, Marshfield, Mass. And it is definitely a pleasure to be here. It's a, you know, it's a really special place. David is a very good friend of mine, and I have another good friend with me, Greg, from the Marshfield group that is followed these directions with us, and he's here with us, so it's nice to have friends. I was here before with Greg and David. As Ozzy mentioned, David's done a lot of work up here, and I came up once and held a paintbrush for about 5 minutes just so I could come up for the weekend and see what it was like. So it was very special, and I was very fortunate. I was asked to speak at the Saturday night meeting here, and I was just so overwhelmed, being my first time at this home that the founder was born in, and and walking around the house he was raised in, and it was such a special treat for me. Is just sitting up here, I had tears. I really had a hard time speaking. I was so overwhelmed with emotion. I had thought about many times coming up to this area, and I'd heard about actually Bill Wilson's grave, and this book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that he's definitely the majority author on. That book has revolutionized my whole life, and it's. I have tunnel vision. Saying to David at breakfast, Greg had a new quarter with a horse and rider on it that reminded me of Paul Revere. And that's a guy that was hanging out a few years ago back where David and I live. And what he did is he didn't tell anybody what to do. He just carried a message. And that's hopefully what we want to do too, is just carry the message. And my message is tunnel vision. There's one book that I'm very familiar with, and that's the book Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a ton of other great books in AA and a ton of other spiritual books, but there's only one that I have any experience on, and that's the big book. I wouldn't say that that other methods are not as nice, but it's one that I wholeheartedly endorse. It's a book that's changed my life, and that's why it's such a special place for me, is to be up here. And I remember having those images of his grave. I heard that there were medallions placed on it, and I had this picture in my mind of a little tiny gravestone with just like heaped with medallions of 20 years, 30 years, and things like that. And I remember going up there and looking at the grave, and I just was overwhelmed. I had tears in my eyes looking at the grave. So it's nice to be here. And I guess what we'd like to do is we can start by basically the way I started this process after being sober and being in Alcoholics Anonymous for about a year, perhaps maybe a year and a half, somewhere in that time frame. I ran into the Marshfield Men's Big Book Step Study meeting. I went in there really by accident. I went in with a couple of guys that just had heard about it and wanted to find out what it was about, and I had no idea what kind of a meeting it was, and I just walked in there really without any knowledge of it. And that particular night, they were on Step 11, and something happened to me. For the first time in my life, I just felt completely drawn. I think I really became a member of AA, so to speak, that first night. At least an earnest desire to be a member of AA took place that night I was in that room. And I met my sponsor. I listened to people speak for a while. And there was one particular man, David's friend and my sponsor, who's been here before, and I heard this man speak, and I felt as though he was the guy. I'd asked God prior to the meeting. I'd said, God, help me decide who I should ask to be my sponsor. And during that meeting, this gentleman talked about the good qualities of a sponsor and what to look for in a sponsor. And when he mentioned all these things, I thought, that's just who he is. He's that kind of guy. I could tell by listening to him that he felt in his heart that the reason he was at that meeting was that he was working for God. I knew that in my innermost being, that that was his only purpose, is that he felt like he was working for God, and that's the job that God had given him as an alcoholic to help other alcoholics in recovery. And I asked him, how do I do this thing? How do I do the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? How do I go about that? And what he told me to do, the first direction he said, well, we start at the first step. And he said, the first step is that you take this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, read the doctor's opinion and read the first 60 pages of the book. And he said, look for information pertaining to steps 1 and 2 within that reading. He said, study it, look it over. And he said, when you're done, give me a call, come back, and we'll sit down and we'll talk about it. And that's what happened. I studied it, looked it over, made a few notes with a yellow highlighter. This is the same book, the book I have right here with me today. And when I called him up, he said, well, why don't you come on over? We'll plan on about 3 or 4 hours, and we'll sit down, just two alcoholics, and if we're both alcoholics, we should find a lot of things in this book that we can agree on, and things that make sense to both of us. And that's what we did. We sat down, and we started going over it. And one of the first things that I discovered in this book is the title page, the very title page of this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And he showed me that, and my first thing was, well, geez, I didn't know you recovered from alcoholism. And he said, well, that's what it says right here. The story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And then the next thing that he showed me in this book was over in the foreword to the first edition. He indicated something else right in the very first paragraph on this foreword, which is on XIII. It says in the first paragraph, it says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That was why the book was written. That was its purpose, to show other alcoholics precisely how they had recovered. And another thing that he pointed out to me, which I thought was rather interesting too in going through this, was over on page XX, which is in the last part of the foreword to the second edition, he pointed out some information up in the top of the page. Now, he showed me that the original foreword said that it was printed in 1939, and then the second foreword is printed in 1955, so they've been in business for 16 years. And then this information that's over on page XX, it says, of the alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. And then it says 25% sobered up after some relapses. And I started thinking about the open speaker meeting that I had belonged to in my local area prior to that, and I started thinking about the number of people that I saw coming in and out, and I thought, well, they certainly don't have any rate in their 75% in the recovery rate. I don't know what the rate was, but it had to have been far less than that. So I thought that was pretty impressive information, that what they were talking about is the plan of recovery outlined in this book. Apparently, back in 1955, had some pretty good success rate. So as we started going through this, one of the things he also indicated to me, he said that he wasn't going to ask me to do anything in this program of recovery that he could not point to in this book Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me that he wasn't going to offer me my opinions. He wasn't going to give me anything other than what was talked about right in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So we started in this doctor's opinion and started reviewing it to find out what this Dr. Silkworth had to offer about Alcoholics Anonymous. And right again in the very first paragraph, it says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery in this book." So the very first words in that are indicating that this is a plan of recovery that's included in this book. And then it goes on to talk about this letter, the letter that was written by this Dr. Silkworth, who Bill Wilson considered a medical saint. And if Bill Wilson thinks he was a medical saint, then I concur. He's a medical saint in my book, too. So as we started going through the information in the doctor's opinion, the thing in general, in the general information, there's a number of stories contained within the doctor's opinion, and a couple of different letters and so forth that are in there, and two different letters that the doctor wrote. And within each letter, there's a couple of stories about experiences that the doctor witnessed. He witnessed a couple of different stories that he talks about in here. But I think that what it's talking about when it talks about the doctor's opinion is the medical idea that this particular doctor had at the time that said that alcoholics are different than non-alcoholics, that they are different both bodily and mentally. And he goes on to talk about that by describing this problem that we have, the physical problem that every alcoholic has. And if you don't have this, if you don't have this physical part of the disease, you're not an alcoholic. Only alcoholics have this particular thing that's mentioned over on XXVI. It says that we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcoholics, the action of alcohol on chronic alcoholics is what's called a manifestation of an allergy. And that manifestation of the allergy is the phenomenon of craving. And the allergy is simply an allergy. If somebody is allergic to somebody, in Webster's it says that it means that you have an unusual reaction to a substance that someone else can take in similar quantities without having any reaction to it. And the reaction that I have when I take alcohol is the way it manifests itself is in what's called the phenomenon of craving. And once I have any amount of alcohol in my body, it manifests itself, this allergy, in the area of this phenomenon of craving. And what that means is that phenomenon of craving, phenomenon being something we don't understand, and craving means I want more alcohol. And what the doctor's talking about in here is this craving is something that's beyond human control. It's not something that we can use our human will or our mental powers of reason to say, I don't want any more. If I had a bag of potato chips up here, some of them Lay's potato chips, and you know, they said, you can't just have one. Well, if somebody told me that if I polished off the bag of Lay's potato chips and I was going to go out and spend $1,000, beat somebody up, drive my car into a tree, and you know, do all kinds of nonsense and almost kill myself and land in jail, if I finished the bag of potato chips, I wouldn't finish them. I could have just one potato chip. I could do that. But with alcohol, I don't have that choice. Once I start drinking alcohol, even after hearing all that reasons not to drink, I don't have that power of choice. And that's what the phenomenon of craving is all about. And we are definitely different than non-alcoholics. My younger brother, I have one brother, Barry, and he is not an alcoholic. And I've been over at his house, this is since I've been sober now for a few years, I've been over at his house and I've observed him drinking alcohol. And I watched him one day. I was over there, over for dinner, and he decided that he was going to have an old-fashioned or some sort of a drink he was going to make. And he had like two full bottles of scotch, a bottle of gin, and something else. And he wanted to have an old-fashioned, so he left the house, drove about 8 miles to a package store, and came back. And the whole right away, something seemed odd. I thought, well, why would you leave if there's, you know, two full bottles of whiskey here and more? Why would you hop in the car? I mean, the very minimum I would have done, at least had an eye-opener or two just before I left. So he got up, he drove off, he went and he got this bottle, then he came home and he ground up some ice, he sliced up some oranges, and he made this drink for himself. And, you know, he sat there enjoying it for about a half an hour or 45 minutes, maybe somewhere in that degree. He finished it. A little time went by, and he said to his wife, you know, I think I'll have another one. And she said, are you sure you want to have another one? I think you've had enough already. And he stopped. He thought for like 1 second. He says, yeah, you're right. I have had plenty. And I thought to myself, wow, that has never, ever happened to me. No one has ever said to me after I had one drink, you know, do you think one was plenty for you, Brian? I've answered that question in a million different ways, but never, yes, one was plenty. That has not happened. And I happen to know, whether I know what that was at the time or not, I know that that's the phenomenon of craving that's already taken place in my body that my younger brother does not possess. So he can use his reasoning power to say, no, you're right. Another one may make me feel a little tipsy. You know, another one is that's what I'm looking for. You know, I want to feel a little more tipsy. That first one felt so good, so incredible, that I definitely want another one. And that's what the doctor is talking about in this opinion here. And essentially, that's his main point on this whole thing. But he does point out a number of other things in here that I want to mention, if I can, just briefly. I'm trying to follow a little schedule of how to stay on track, running a little bit late here. And one of the things that he's talking about is once this person has this business, this craving phenomenon, and he's become an alcoholic, it talks about, you know, how can you get him to stop? The sentence here on the same page we're on, 26, says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffice. And it goes on, it says, if these alcoholics are to recreate their lives, then their faith, their ideals, must be grounded in a power greater than themselves. It says this message must have depth and weight to it. And that's the message that I found in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a message here that has depth and weight to it. And I found a way to have exactly that same thing happen to me. And I think that this Dr. Silkworth, his opinion is about the disease Alcoholics Anonymous, but his actual experience is about watching alcoholics that he had pronounced hopeless and he had seen before many of them die. There's data in some books that says that he worked on 50,000 alcoholics. And out of that 50,000, he had about 2% success rate. And then what happened, he saw this program, and it goes on to talk about that in this chapter. It talks about, essentially, Bill Wilson. I'll get to that 1 second if I can. But on the same page, he goes on in the bottom here to talk about, he says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect that is produced by alcohol. And if we're in this room, I guess, you know, we all know that's why we drank, is we like the effect produced by alcohol. That's why, you know, I always feel really comfortable in a room full of alcoholics because I'm an alcoholic, and if you are alcoholics and we talk about the information in this book, I mean, I'm not inventing anything. This is stuff that we both know. You know, that's the information in here of the changes that happen once we have drinks. And it talks about this problem. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate true from false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks they see others taking with impunity, others that do not have the allergy to alcohol. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the stages of a spree, they emerge remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again, but it says this is repeated over and over again, unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. There is little hope of his recovery. And then here, the next chapter, the next paragraph, this has got the good news for us. On the other hand, in strange as this might seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. Now, this is the part my sponsor pointed out that I missed. The only effort necessary is that he is required to follow a few simple rules. And I would have went right over that. And I remember when he mentioned it, I said, rules where? And I looked back down again because I had heard there are no rules.
Right. No suggestions.
So, but Dr. Silkworth, he thought that there were a few rules. And the way my sponsor explained that to me, he said, if you want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there is only one rule to be a member of the fellowship. That is a desire not to drink. He said, but if you want to recover from alcoholism, he said, this book says there are a few simple rules and requirements. And he told me that he was going to point them out to me and show me where they were. And I'll tell you, I am eternally grateful that he did. So now, to point out just a couple of things as we were going through this, there are some types of alcoholics that Silkworth mentions on page XXVIII. He talks about different... Now, when I was reading these over with my sponsor, we're going over them, I didn't find too much identification with the first several types in the book. I did know other people who were just like this. When we read the type that says the psychopaths, I thought real quick, I said, oh, that's my father. That's his type. That's the kind of alcoholic he is. And then when we went on and we said, and then there's the type of alcoholic unwilling to admit that he can't take a drink. Well, I knew a couple like that that I drank with that were just like that. Says that they're always going on the wagon and so forth, saying that because they can stay sober on the wagon that they're not really an alcoholic. And there were a couple of guys in the bar that used to do that on a regular basis. And then it talked about the manic depressive type. And I knew a whole family of manic depressives, and a few of them were alcoholics, and I knew that kind of alcoholic. But as to this going through here, I didn't see anything that I could really relate to until I got to the last one here. It says, then there are the types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. And they are often able, intelligent, friendly people. And I had that highlighted. That was what I had highlighted in here and underlined. That was my type.
We all fell into that category.
And it's funny, I was going over, I see how silly that is to me, how silly that I can see that I'm like all those types now. But I was just going over this information one day with a young man that's in prison. I just talked to him yesterday. And I was going over the same thing. And when he got down to that, he said, yeah, that's my type. That's what I am. So I know I'm not alone. And I knew that Silkworth knew what he had in mind when he put that in there. He had me in mind. But it goes on to say that basically it doesn't matter what type you are, because it says all these have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. And then the doctor tells us what we can do about this phenomenon of craving. There's only one cure back here in 1939 for the phenomenon of craving, and it's the only thing that works today, and that is entire abstinence. That's the only thing that works against the phenomenon of craving, is entire abstinence. There is no other way to do it. You just, if you don't want the allergy to occur, you can't drink alcohol. And it, and once you have this, this is a gift from God, because you can never get rid of it. That phenomenon of craving, that allergy to alcohol, will stay with you the rest of your life. And not everybody can have that either. You know, if you're a drug addict, you know, and you give anybody, you take 100 people off the street and you give them all heroin 3 or 4 times, well, they're all going to become heroin addicts. But that doesn't happen with an alcoholic. You actually have to be special. Alcoholics are not normal people.
Don't you feel better now?
Not everybody can have that. You can't work into it. You have to have been born that way with an allergy. So the doctor, again, he points out here, he says on page XXIX, he says, so what is the solution? And basically now he talks about a couple of different experiences. He talks about this man that, he talks about each one of them, the one thing they have in common is that they accepted the plan outlined in this book, and they have not had a drink since. That's basically what he's saying in each one of those, and that's been Dr. Silkworth's experience on the program, is that it works. You know, he had Bill Wilson come in there, and David will talk more about that in a minute, but Bill Wilson tells about that in the beginning of the letter here. He talks about the idea that he saw this man come in who was a wreck. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. And then later on, he came back to the hospital, and he asked if he could tell his story to other alcoholics. And it says, with some misgivings, we consented. And then he said, the stories that follow are amazing. I missed my page where I am here. But he says that the stories are miraculous, that they are amazing, the things that have been overcome. In the last page of the doctor's letter is one that's happened to me. The very last sentence in here says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he may have come to scoff, he may remain to pray. And that's what's happened with me. Thank you. David?
Thanks, Frank. You know, one of the bits of history about the Big Book the question is always, why did in the first printing of the first edition, they had the doctor's opinion was page 1, and then the second printing they changed it to Bill's story was page 1. So I think it's that, and I think it's the reason Bill's story was put in the book to begin with was that. When they put the book out, you know, it wasn't like there was a lot of meetings. A lot of these books were just being requested by mail and sent out, or sent to hospitals and sent all over the country. And so it was people who were going to grab this book, alcoholics who were, you know, and I don't know of any alcoholic that picked up this book for social reading. You know, so these people were hurting, you know. And when you open up a book and you look at page 1 and you're looking at a doctor talking, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was back, you know, in the sick thinking days, you know, I wouldn't have trusted anybody, especially a doctor. So I think that's why they changed it. And that's also the reason why I think they put Bill's story in the beginning before getting us into the conversion process, was because they want to give us something to identify with. You know, Brian, you know, started to talk about that, the types of alcoholics. And the doctor even knew all the symptoms of an alcoholic. In Bill's story, I consider it the perfect drunkalogue. You know, we can go through Bill's story as a good example. A drunkalogue is basically what we do when we do a 12-step call. It's, you know, it's the directions we're given. When you read Bill's story and then you go and read the 12th step in the Big Book, you'll see similarities as to first they tell something about themselves,
to be able to gain your confidence, to get the idea that we know what we're talking about. Brian again touched on that when him and George would talk. You know, you get two people together that are alcoholics and they start to identify. Well, my experience is that, and I think that's the book too, is that the sick alcoholic, our job is to first, in whatever way, is gain their confidence through our experience. So what Bill does when he goes through his story is he does that. He's first just telling you about him and his life and his thinking. And so the perfect drunkologue would go from, this is in 12th step, it would go from gaining our confidence to slowly defining the problem. And then we can identify in either our stories or Bill's stories the bottom he hits. And then we can identify the solution being introduced to him. And then finally we can see the program of action. And then of course Bill ends within that program of action. It's helping another alcoholic as in our 12th step. So in Bill's story, what we're going to look for, what we want to look for are the main things of the 12 steps of recovery. First, we want to look for the problem. And Brian, in the doctor's opinion, defined mostly the physical part, and Dr. Silkworth talked about the psychic change. He didn't really talk as much about what we'll talk about in more about alcoholism, and also, here's the solution, alcoholic insanity. You know, when they talk about being insane in step two, I didn't understand that either. I thought insane meant that you were unable to function in reality. Well, it really just means that with respect to alcohol, my thinking is insane. It could be in all aspects, other aspects of my life. You know, I may seem normal, but when it comes to alcohol, I'm strangely insane. It's like I'm just missing a few spots off my dice, not all of them, you know. So in Bill's story, you know, he starts off, one of the things that I identified right away was the fear. I had this tremendous fear of always feeling like I was different than everybody else in the world my whole life. And that was pre-drinking, but, you know, especially through my drinking, and that's one of the reasons I drank, I found out. You know, the fear that was feeding the obsession to drink. So as we go through Bill's story, you know, he starts out with his drinking career when he was in the Army, and he says, when he talks about getting into the war, he says, here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. And that's what I felt like when I would get into a group like that. You know, I felt like I could fit in finally where I always didn't. On page two, the next wording of talking about his feelings and how he felt in life, he says, the drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world I was important. I don't know about you, but my whole life, my whole existence was to feed my self-esteem. So I needed to prove all day long to everybody in the world that I was good. And these are the things that in the beginning of Bill's story you see about his life. And it's also right at the beginning is when he discovered alcohol in the war. One of the things that I identify with Bill was in the beginning of his drinking, he said that when he was in school, he talks about potential alcoholic that I was. And I missed that for a long time. You know, and obviously he knew that there was the problem there. To even label himself potential alcoholic. As Brian says, his brother probably never even asked himself, am I an alcoholic? There was no reason. So here, you know, we see that Bill already knew that there was a problem. And right after that line, when he was in his law school, he says, at one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. He says, though my drinking was not continuous, it disturbed my wife. You know, he went on through his life as I did. You know, I had this idea of what life was about and how I was supposed to live it. And so what we can see through Bill's story is that that's what he's doing. Except we're slowly going to see how the drinking starts to take a more important role in his life. And now this is what we're looking at. We're looking for a progression, and we're also looking for the thinking that precedes the first drink. You know, in the first four chapters plus the doctor's opinion, you know, is really step one and two. In the big book, they don't label, this is step one, this is step two. The first step reference is in the third step. And one of the things I wanted to mention, it says our description to the of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostics, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Those are the questions I can ask myself before making a third step decision, is that I need to come to some conclusions about whether I'm an alcoholic. Therefore, you know, we admitted we were alcoholics and that our lives had become unmanageable, and that came to believe that a power could restore us to sanity. Therefore, we have to understand some conclusions about ourselves. So in Bill's story, when we're looking for the progression of alcoholism, when we're looking for his insane thinking, what we're doing is we're looking for the information to help us come to two conclusions, to help us make a decision. So in Bill's story, one of the lines that he said when he finally did make success in business, he says, I had arrived. You know, and I felt that over and over in my life. But the problem was is that once I thought I had arrived, I immediately went right down to the bottom of the barrel again. So I had to go try and arrive again. And it was that, you know, which I came to understand is the self-esteem and the fear that drove my life. Again, he continues on talking about my drinking assumed more serious proportions. We're just looking for the progression. He still thinks that his life is going wonderful. You know, he sees that drinking is a problem as I did. I didn't see how they were related. What I did in my life was I thought there were other reasons why certain aspects of my life weren't going well, but I didn't understand that it had anything to do with alcohol. So, on page 5 is when Bill starts to really see, I think in a different perspective, the effect alcohol is having on his life when he says, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, often 3, got to be routine. You know, and he also sees here where work is starting to be a problem. And at the bottom of that paragraph, he says, nevertheless, I thought I could still control the situation. There were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse. And then the next paragraph, he says, I woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I think this is where Bill finally, for the first time, realized that he was powerless over alcohol. You know, he saw that this had to be stopped. He says, I was through forever. He says, I saw I could not take so much as one drink. And that's what Brian was talking about in the doctor's opinion. For the first time saw that once he took a drink, he was off running. I don't know if he recognized it before, but I think this is where he, for the first time, got honest with himself about it. You know, the other thing about Bill's story, I want to leave some, we need to leave time for there is a solution. Again, what we're looking for is right after this time when Bill actually knows what's going on, he gets drunk again. He says, I had written sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly after I came home drunk, there had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Right there is where we're showing the alcoholic insanity. You know, Bill had been successful in business, and his other aspects of his life were fine. But here, he's starting to question.
I don't think he relates the two, but he's beginning to believe that he's just crazy. Same thing happened to me at the end of my drinking. I had known I had a drinking problem for a long time, but when I finally hit my bottom, I'm curled up on my sister's bed, you know, not knowing what is going on with me. So I didn't have any idea it was alcohol. See, Bill just thinks he's crazy. You know, he doesn't know that it's alcohol. So what he does is he goes back and forth. He keeps trying to use his self-will and his knowledge and all this to stay sober. And the paragraph that I think really describes Bill hit the absolute bottom before he became willing to ask for help was on page 8 when it says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched all around me, stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." You know, and he leaves the hospital and, you know, he ends up drinking again. And, you know, he's already at his bottom and he's going down farther now. And this is where Ebby, his friend, comes in. And, you know, one simple way I like to remember, if anything, just the history and in the part of the process of what we're doing here is when Brian talked about Dr. Silkworth and talking and defining the problem, you know, Dr. Silkworth knew the problem, but he couldn't be successful in changing these people. You know, he knew that there needed to be a psychic change. He could see that, you know, that once you put the alcohol into the system, you know, you are off and running if you're an alcoholic. But he also knew that the problem preceded the first drink. It wasn't, you know, once you got the alcohol in you. In other words, we're always sober when we pick up the first drink, unless we're on a binge, but in general. You know, so it's something with our thinking. And that goes along with what Brian first pointed out was the book says that we have recovered. We don't recover from the physical allergy that we have to alcohol. We will always possess that. What we recover from is a seemingly hopeless case of the mind and the body. So once we are restored to sanity, and that's where sanity comes in, that's when we can consider ourselves recovered. So what the doctor does is he lays out what the problem is. He knows what the problem is. And one of the things that Bill found out from the doctor was that he needed, remember I talked about the psychic change. So when Ebby came to him with the solution, you know, what he came to him was the program of action to create this psychic change. And if we have time, I'll tell a story later on about a little more about how that message got to Ebby. But so in the end of Bill's story, and I don't want to go through each step, but it is interesting to see because see now we've seen what I started talking about in Bill's story to begin with. We've seen the progression of Bill's drinking, the progression of Bill's thinking, and now we see where his thinking, we can identify the alcoholic insanity in his life. And so what we're looking now is that Bill has a willingness, and you can read it when Ebby comes to visit him, and then Ebby visits him in the hospital. What they do is he lays out this program of action that Ebby found. And from that, and you can read it in the rest of Bill's story, is that Bill actually lays out the 12 steps as he did them in Towns Hospital. And from that, he had his spiritual awakening. And the main thing that he talks about after was in the 12th step, is that his job now is to go out and help somebody else. And so what we're going to do is, Brian's going to finish up this morning before the break with There is a Solution. Again, looking for the information to come to some conclusions before we get to the third step decision. Brian?
Well, let's see. There is a Solution, which is chapter 2 in the book. And, you know, moving right along, it indicates if you're reading the book in order here, it starts right off by saying, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. And that's what we're talking about in recovery, is solving the drink problem. And it goes on to talk a little bit about how that's going to take place. The chapter being, There is a Solution, we're talking a little bit about how we solve that drink problem. In the first place, one of the things my sponsor had indicated to me when we were going over this material, he said anything in this book that has italicized writing that the author at least thought it was of extra importance. So my sponsor would always point out anything in italicized writing in here. And the first thing we come to is on page 18, talks about how this thing's going to work. It says, the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in just a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be done. And that's the kind of understanding that was taking place with me and my sponsor in spending these hours together, these 3 or 4 hours of going over the book. I could certainly see that he was an ex-problem drinker who was definitely armed with the facts about himself. And that's what made me trust him. And once that trust took place, that set in motion this ability to recover from alcoholism. And it talks a little bit about that, what the problem is as we see it, as David was just alluding to in the end of Bill's story, is that the real problem here, it goes on first, let's just take a look at page 20, 21. Down the bottom of page 20, it says, moderate drinkers, it gives you the difference now about what an alcoholic is and so forth. Moderate drinkers have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain kind of a hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. But if he has a sufficiently strong reason, for instance, ill health, falling in love, warning of a doctor, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, may even need medical attention. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker, which I did. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, which I did. But at some stage of my drinking career, I began to lose all control of my liquor consumption once I started to drink. That's when I really became an alcoholic, when I had lost control of my liquor consumption once I took the first drink. You know, the first day in high school that I smuggled my first pint of Southern Comfort and Coke down to the beach, I don't know if I had lost complete control, although a few people on the bus may have thought so when they went looking for me and found me face down in the sand. They may have thought I lost control back then. I felt that I had just was beginning my career and spent many years trying to improve that edge and pushing that envelope as best I could so I could be a true Irishman and be able to really hold my liquor. But I know that in the end, I know that I had finally got to that point that once I put any alcohol into me, I was lost. I remember when I got arrested for driving under. I woke up from that craziness, and I thought to myself, and I started considering the facts ahead, and I thought, well, if I get caught again, my whole business is gone. My life is over as I know it if I get caught again. One more time and I'm dead. So I started thinking, how am I going to be able to guarantee that I'll never get behind a car and drive drunk? And I thought, well, that'd be easy enough. I'll just have my friends, you know, pick me up, take me down to the bar. And then I thought, no, not you, Brian. You know, once you're feeling good, once you're over that edge, you'll do anything. You know, if I'm out looking for whatever it is, drugs, sex, whatever it is, more alcohol, whatever the goal is at the time, I'll do anything. Once I've taken that first drink, I really don't have any control over how much I take afterwards, because it just starts putting sections of my brain to sleep, and the first one that goes to sleep is that the power to reason. That's the part that gets, you know, anesthetized right away, is my power to make choices. And it continues to get worse as the more alcohol I put into my system. So even though I didn't understand phenomenon of craving really as far as the way the doctor explains it, I definitely knew that I had this problem. Once I started to drink, I didn't have any control. So that's the guy that's been puzzling us, it says, this guy that has his lack of control. He may be, it says down at the bottom of the page 21, he might be sensible and well-balanced concerning everything else but liquor, but in this respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. So it starts talking a little bit more about this kind of a guy, like, why does he behave like this? Why is it that if hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle, I'm on page 22, with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of his common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays in regard to other matters? Well, perhaps, it says, now this is interesting, perhaps there will never be a full answer to this question. Opinions vary as to why the alcoholic reacts differently than normal people. Basically, what the book is saying, it says, we cannot answer the riddle. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't know why that happens. We know that as long as we keep away from it, we might be okay. But we are equally positive that once he takes the drink of alcohol into the system, something happens both bodily and mentally, which is beyond his control. So it's talking about this. It says, so now, on the page 23, it says up in the first paragraph, the observations like this would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, setting that cycle into motion. So it says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. As David pointed out, the body thing we're never going to do anything about by except not drinking. That's the only answer for that. So it says, the main problem centers in his mind. And if you ask him, you ask the alcoholic why he took that drink, it says, well, he might have 100 alibis. And it says some of them may have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense, it says, in the light of havoc that the alcoholic's drinking bout creates. And then it goes on to say in the next paragraph, once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you do. And it says, in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. And once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. And then it says, there is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, that they will be able to, in other words, control their desire for drink, and that's what the book talks about when it mentions obsession. It's the idea that somehow or other I'm going to beat this thing. And I used to spend a long time doing that. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd think, well, you know, I'm just not going to drink scotch, and I'm not going to do any cocaine tonight. I'll just have a couple of Heinekens, you know, and that's something I tried to do for like 20 years, try and figure out how to work that. And each time it made sense to me. Each time when I woke up, it made sense. So that's the obsession, is that somehow, someday, we're going to beat the game and figure out how to do it. Down the bottom of the page, it says, the tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may never arrive. He is never going to be able to regain his control once he's lost it. Over on page 24, in italicized writing, what it's talking about here is the insanity, really, that precedes the first drink. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. It says we are unable at certain times to bring into our conscious bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. You know, after a real interesting night that I might have had, a number of years ago, when I woke up in the morning thinking, wow, what in the Christ did I do last night? And I'd be wondering, you know, the first thing is taking a peek out to see if the car was out there, be looking around the apartment to see if anybody was there, you know, and I'd start to think about some of the recall, some of the evening, and I'd be thinking about, you know, like maybe who I had sex with, how much money I spent on cocaine, how much whiskey I drank, what I said to people, and I would be overwhelmed with guilt. I would start thinking, oh my God, I didn't do that, did I? Did I say that? Did I do that? I'd be like, and things would be coming to my mind as I'd be like getting ready to go to work and trying to get organized for the day. I'd be thinking about stuff, and I would be so stricken with guilt, I'd just have shivers go up and down my spine thinking, oh, no, man, I didn't do that. Did I? Did I do that? And then other things that I couldn't even remember, they were worse. The stuff that, you know, the blank spots wondering, I wonder what I did. You know, in the places where I don't even remember, you know, the last place I remember is being at the Polish Club, and that was 8 o'clock. And I know I didn't go home then, you know? So then the rest of the night being a mystery, I would even think worse things about what had possibly happened. So when I was feeling that way that morning, at that point in time, I could bring into my mind with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of that night. And I wasn't going to drink that minute. You know, that hour, I would not drink. I'd say, I'm never drinking again. And I would be able to hold that in sufficient force into my memory right then, that humiliation and suffering. But what happens shortly after that, maybe later on that day, maybe the next day, maybe the day after, it says what happens is suddenly those, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into our mind to deter us. That's when I start thinking, well, maybe I could just have a Heineken. And it says, if these thoughts do occur, it says they are hazy, and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. You know, there is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. You know, when you get burned once, you never did it again. Well, that doesn't work in alcoholism. You know, and that idea, that suffering and humiliation, it was amazing how, like, 2 days later, I thought, well, you know, I could just go down to the bar and have a couple of beers. Maybe it wasn't that bad. You know, and the funny thing, once I get down there, sat down, started talking to a few people, turns out I wasn't all as bad as I thought I was. And then when I had a few more scotches or something like that and started hearing about it, some of the stuff was actually kind of funny. You know, it wasn't all that bad at all. And soon the whole problem was gone away, and the cycle repeated. And I was waking up the following morning in the same mess that I was in, a few mornings before. So that's alcoholism. And now in this chapter it talks about, as we mentioned, there is a solution. So, like, what is the solution to this insanity that precedes the first drink? How do we do that? Page 25, there is a solution. It talks right on that page, and I'll tell you, I'll skip the first paragraph for a second, and I'll go right to the second paragraph. It says, and this is me, this is what's happened to me. The great fact is just this and nothing less. I have had a deep and effective spiritual experience which has revolutionized my whole attitude toward life, toward my fellows, and toward God universe. The central fact of my life today is the absolute certainty that my Creator has entered into my heart and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish the things in my life which I could have never done by myself. That's what's happened. That's what the solution is, a vital spiritual experience. that's the solution if you want to recover from alcoholism. And then it tells us in the paragraph above that a little bit about how that's accomplished. It says there is a solution. And here's what I found. Almost none of us like the self-searching. That's what it says. The leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. And when I first heard about this, and we'll talk about the fourth step later on today, when I started getting an inkling of some of the things that was going to be in this inventory, I didn't like it at all, not one bit. But what it tells us right here, and I got it underlined from my sponsor going over it, he says, which the process requires for its successful consummation. So that's different than hearing that there aren't any rules, because what it says is, like this self-searching, leveling of our pride, confession of our shortcomings. But we saw that it really worked in others. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. So when we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up this kit of this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And then what happened? We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence which we had not even dreamed. And that's what happened to me. I was living in a three-dimensional world with five senses, and I'm living in a four-dimensional world today with six senses. And that was the vital spiritual experience, was acquiring that sixth sense.
I think what we'll do is just the end of this chapter is that little bit of history, which is a good spot right here to bring it up, because as Brian just introduced the solution, was in the next paragraph, it talks about, I won't read it, but you can read about him. It says a certain American businessman had good sense and high character. And this happened back in 1931. You know, as I said, you know, when Dr. Soakworth worked for years and years with alcoholics, and over those years he started to understand he saw the obsession of the mind, he saw the physical compulsion of the allergy, and he knew that they needed to change the thinking, because if we change the thinking, we don't get to the compulsion. Problem was, is he didn't know how to do that. Obviously, the success rate, probably those weren't real alcoholics, you know. I don't know, but you know, he just couldn't figure out how to change him. In this story, at the end of There is a Solution, this is Roland Hazard back in 1931. Roland Hazard was an alcoholic who went over to Carl Jung over in Europe, and Jung was, you know, a psychiatrist equal to Freud in the day. And the history I've heard is that he tried to see Freud, and Freud was too busy, or, you know, he was sick or something. He couldn't see him. And thank God for that, because Carl Jung believed in the spiritual connection in one's thinking. So he spent a year with Carl Jung, and Carl Jung did whatever psychiatrists do to try and change somebody's thinking. And I think in maybe normal people, non-alcoholics, maybe it works. I'll never know. I'm an alcoholic, and I know it wouldn't have worked for me. But he went over there and he spent a year with him. And he, you know, he says that, you know, I thought, because I had learned so much about me and my mind and exactly why I drank and everything, that he never thought he'd drink again. Well, very quickly he goes out and he's drunk again. And he runs back to Carl Jung and says, you know, what happened? You know, I thought you had changed my thinking, so I wouldn't pick up that first drink. And you know, Carl Jung just says, I'm sorry, I can't help you. You're hopeless. You know, and I can picture that, you know, coming into an AA meeting and somebody just saying, sorry, you're hopeless. You know, I mean, that's what I expected when I came in here, because that's the way I felt in my life. And I thought that there wasn't a solution because I hadn't come up with it, you know, when I came into AA. So anyway, he, at the end of that conversation, you know, Roland Hazard says to him, he says, you know, is there no hope? And the doctor said to him, he says, you know, well, there is. Upon, in rare occasions, once in a while, you know, this is almost never. Alcoholics have been had to have had to have been known on vital spiritual experiences. And he says, but we don't know how to create that. And so, you know, in the story, you know, he says he didn't go away feeling really too good, you know. He does say, you know, though his church, you know, his beliefs, his some of his practices were good, it didn't spell out the necessary vital experience to expel that obsession for alcohol. So I don't know the story of exactly how, and I'm not sure anybody does, the how Roland Hazard, after leaving the doctor, came in contact with the Oxford group, whether he did it over in Europe or whether he did it here in the States. But what he did was he got in contact with what at the time were the Oxford groups. Today they are called the MRA, which is Moral Rearmament. But they had their whole reason for existence, they called themselves life changers. So their whole existence was to help people have a vital spiritual experience. So Roland Hazard went to them, did what they said, had his spiritual experience. Now Roland Hazard, you know, so therefore now we have the solution. You know, Carl Jung gave, well, us, the solution to our problem, but he didn't know the program of action. Roland Hazard found the Oxford group and got the program of action. So that's our whole process right there. And then Roland Hazard saved Debbie. In the book it talks about two men saving Debbie from being locked up for alcoholic insanity. So what he did was, it was Roland Hazard who saved Debbie from going into the insane asylum, and therefore that's how Ebby got the message to Bill. So it's a nice connection to see in the book, one, you know, our the problem, the solution, the program of action, and a little bit of history of exactly how the message got from person to person along the way, and now it eventually gets to us through this wonderful book of ours. Why don't we make it a 10-minute break? And we'll resume back at, how about 25 of 11? Thanks.
Thank you.
Again, I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. And I neglected to say where I'm from. I'm a member of the Tuesday night Big Book Step Study meeting in Newton, Mass. We meet on Tuesday nights at 7:30. Nice thing about our little Step Study meetings, they're growing all over the place. In the Northeast here. This afternoon I will have a meeting list printout up front here for, well, it's pretty much up to date of all the meetings that are in our area. So if people are interested in to go to meetings where people talk like we talk, you can go to those places. Before lunch, what we're going to do is we're going to cover more about alcoholism, we agnostics, and then take you through the third step. Again, you know, these whole chapters are helping us come to the conclusions that we need to make before we can make a decision. Again, you know, back in my pre-big book process days in AA, I thought that making a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God was just, you know, like a permanent thing, as I said, and then I went out and started to run my life. Well, when people started talking about, well, what happened to step one and two, you know, I didn't understand really how they were relevant. I thought I could just read them and say, you know, yeah, drinking was my problem, and, you know, I seemed to be nuts in some areas of my life, you know. But when it came to understanding that I really needed to do something about this thinking problem, you know, or my life was going to continue to get worse, is when I had to really start looking at, all right, what really am I making a decision about in step three? So again, we're looking for
all the information we need to make the conclusions in step one and step two to make a decision. And more about alcoholism, what they do is they give us examples of the thinking that precedes the drink. Brian gave some wonderful stories about that. In the beginning of the chapter, there are three words they use. I'd like to read the beginning part of this chapter. It says, most of us were unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. And again, we've had the review of what a real alcoholic is. No person likes to think that he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. I look at the obsession when I think of pre being restored to sanity as it's like a river that was running in my life and in me. And as I look back over my drinking and really saw that my thinking was totally obsessed with alcohol, feeling to feel better, to escape, whatever the reasons were at that moment, all I needed to see was that I possessed this obsession and that the insanity didn't allow me to make choices. So he says, this is the great obsession that I'm going to be able to control this somehow. So that obsession is driving that force. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, presently maybe, has to be smashed. So somehow, and again, this is really only a conclusion. I mean, when I was at this point, you know, I talked with my sponsor over and over about these chapters. And I'll tell you, I didn't understand much of it. I mean, it's crystal clear to me today, and I love going to meetings, and you know, especially Brian, I love listening to talk about the Big Book. It's crystal clear, but I needed to relate it to me. And so, going through these chapters, you know, all this stuff was pointed out, and now in this chapter, very simply, some of the thinking that precedes the first drink. If I could just identify with that, to understand that I possess this inability to leave it alone, is really the goal of this chapter, is just to show me the examples of that. Over on page 31, despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in this class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone is showing inability to control his drinking, can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. And again, Brian's examples were perfect. You know, they seem ridiculous and they seem funny. But go back to that exact situation, it was pretty sad. You know, and it was hopeless. You know, to be in that state and not, first of all, not know it. Earlier on in the book we said the inability to differentiate the truth from the false. That's where early in my drinking career, I saw more truth, I think. But as the progression of my thinking went downhill, my ability to see the truth diminished with it. And so, Some of the thinking that precedes the first drink can include our excuses, you know, which all falls under the category of alcoholic insanity. And the first ones they use are, here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only. Limiting the number of drinks. Never drinking alone. Never drinking in the morning. You know, limiting the number of drinks was like me just not paying attention to the check. You know, I only had to be amazed once at the end of the night. You know, it's not like, you know, because I would never want to just pay for them, because then the guilt would start, and you know, I'd be thinking, oh, I shouldn't be doing it. I didn't even pay attention to it, because then I had to worry about it at the end of the night, feeling bad. Drinking alone, well, I was sitting in a bar with other people. You know, it's not like I felt like I was alone, even though I was alone. You know, I didn't really connect that line with the fact that the waitress at the bar, the bartender used to write on the top of the check at this one bar, Miller guy. I thought that was funny. You know, it's not like, you know, I wasn't alone. But, you know, when I started to read this stuff, these are the kinds of things, the stories Brian tells, the things that come back to me to help me understand where I didn't see the truth in my life. This is the beginning of this whole process. You know, Bill talks about, in the 12 and 12, he says there's only one key, and the key is willingness. That willingness, as in our examples so far, have shown that we have to be willing in all the way through this process to be able to search for the truth. The moment we stop that, the only thing that we can go back on is our own thinking. So these are some of the examples, you know, drinking in the morning, not drinking at home, never having it in the house, drinking during business hours. You know, these were excuses we used all along. And I went through and I identified with tons and tons of them. People are different, you know, just like the types of alcoholics. Some alcoholics who are the same alcoholic as me were socialites. I wasn't a socialite. So the important thing is that I don't compare myself to them. The point is that I start identifying with simple little things like this, because we both thought the same way in this respect. And then it tells us that, you know, if you're not convinced, it says, we do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take you long to decide if you are honest. Okay? Differentiate the truth from the false again. You know, to the best of our ability, if you are honest with yourself, it may be worth a bad case of the jitters if you will get a full knowledge of your condition. Though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early on in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But it is difficult. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. At one time, I heard a story of a guy, Father Tom Weston, out in California. This got me thinking about when I was 18 to 24, maybe those days, when I remember when I was 24, it was the first time I think I remember considering myself an alcoholic. Not that I knew what one was, but I knew I was different. But Father Tom Weston talks about the different stages of alcoholism. And that stage of my life was the fun phase. You know, if we go back and remember, we were just having fun. We thought we were the same as everybody else. But after 24, maybe the 24 to 28 was the fun plus problems stage, where I started to identify that there was problems going on. And maybe relate sometimes that they had to do with alcohol, but would lie to myself and say no and continue on. And then I believe 28 to 35, when I got sober, was the problems stage. You know, there's probably a final stage. But, you know, this is why, as Bill says, early on, most people who could have, you know, if we could have stopped, we wouldn't have. We didn't have sufficient reason. We were having too much fun. You know, and today I realize I wasn't, but I didn't know it then. The other analogy for young people trying to get sober is there's three things that alcoholics have going against them. One of them is youth, and it's very difficult, and I know from my experience, to get sober young. The other one was money. You know, if we got money, we're gonna pay to get our lives manageable again. And the other one is brains. And unfortunately, I meet an awful lot of intelligent alcoholics in AA. So I immediately can see why they were out there that long, you know. So so what they do, the rest of the chapter is giving us examples of the insanity that precedes the first drink. The first example is a man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he could not get anywhere if he drank at all. All right, so he identified early on that there was a problem, and he wanted to. So for some reason, he was able to stop drinking. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and retired, he would not touch another drop. You know, some people say that, you know, alcoholics don't have any willpower. Well, I think we got a lot of willpower. And this is an example of what some people can do. I mean, I consider my father, I don't know if he was an alcoholic, but boy, he had all the traits and isms that I had, and he didn't drink. You know, there's a lot of willpower in people. And I think in a case like this, this guy was, I don't know if you want to call him lucky, but he was able to stop. And then unfortunately, the end of his story, you know, once he was successful and retired, he was dead within 4 years because he started drinking. He thought he could drink like other people.
That concludes the first of 6 tapes, The Big Book Experience, a Step Workshop Weekend with Dave F. and Chris S. Be sure to come back when I rotate these tapes. The next tape will be Steps 2 and 3 and the beginning of 4 Step Inventory.